What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This is the One Heat Minute Productions Patreon First Look podcast, where we go back 10 years into our rearview to see what films are still hanging around, what filmmakers are still hanging around, most importantly, or what things are just ripe for rediscovery. Now, we are taking the biggest flex and stretch ever, thanks to my great guest, the legendary movie newsman, original movie blog OG Garth Franklin is here, one of my dearest friends. Say hello, Garth.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome. Huge friend of the show and everything we do at One Heat Minute Productions, one of our chief instigators. And when we were looking at the list of 2015 films, Garth came back to me with a suggestion, which is Tom at the Farm. Incredible Xavier Dolan film that we saw together. And just before I let you guys listen to a trailer, this is one of the funnest IMDb release date deep dives I've ever done on any film, because in Italy in September of 2013 at the Venice Film Festival, this film premiered. But Garth and I did not see Tom at the Farm together until June of 2014 in its Sydney, Australia debut. It had actually already debuted at the Brisbane Film Festival, the kind of what was then a big existing film festival in Australia. It wasn't for a little while, is kind of back now, and actually officially got a formal release date in Australia at cinemas. It got a release date much later than that, something like October, and August 14 of 2015 is when it was released in the United States. It actually only just got in Spain. There was a limited subtitle version that was released in 2016. So a 3-year gap. Cover that as you will, but we're considering it via very liberally via its American release date for the purposes of the Decade Project. So what I want you to do is listen to this tense and in Quebecy French, Montreal French trailer, and we're going to come back and talk all about it. Okay, Garth, this is a great one for us. Why I was like, let's make the stretch is because you and I had like a fantastic experience with two films by Xavier Dolan in 2014 at the Sydney Film Festival. Mm-hmm. One was Fresh Mummy, which had been fresh out of Cannes. It was huge there, won a grand jury prize. We'd heard about that. We're like, bang, we're getting that on the list. And then sort of around the same time, they're like Tom at the Farm as well. So there's a Xavier Dolan double, like, 2 years in a row of films that he's made, both excellent. And so I saw Mummy alone. You saw it on a screener. Is that right? You saw it?
Yeah, like that's right. So I think you saw Mummy and like were raving about it. And I'd seen one or two of Dolan's other films. And I asked for it and they had the screeners available for it. And so that next morning, I watched it in the morning And then we had Tom at the Farm that night. I'm like, damn, I'm in.
Yeah. So we did, and we got to see this film together. That Sydney Film Festival was a fun experience, especially at that time. It was kind of the peak of the festival, like the new wave it has. I don't think it's really hit its straps like it was in the mid-2010s. Like that was when it was, you know, early 2010s, mid-2010s. It was firing on all cylinders. They were great.
Yeah, sort of since the pandemic, it hasn't really come back the same.
It's never been quite the same, and I would argue that for a quite stack of years before that, it was nowhere near what it was at this time. And this is one of the best fests I ever remember, that 2014, 2013 time. It was unbelievable. It was a really rapturous crowd. People were fired up about A Dolan Double, and there were lots of similar audiences. We had lots of different friendlies in town, local critics, international folk that had popped out for it, jury members, and obviously just the punters, which is great. And that screening, Mummy was a bit more divisive in the room. So a bit more of an extreme film, but there were like people who walked out like I did, who were evangelizing it immediately, and some people that were kind of perplexed by it. Tom at the Farm was not that experience. It was a universally down to clown for this kind of contemporary Hitchcockian psychosexual torment and grief movie. And we walked out of that and I was like, that might have even been better than Mummy. Like, that was amazing. we had a great time. What was your experience with it at the time? I'm sort of projecting a lot on both of us because we had a lot of fun with it. But tell me about your experience.
Well, it's a different thing, I think, because Mummy is a very high energy kind of just real auteur kind of thing. And it's just so it's beautiful in moments. So the whole thing, you know, the whole thing doesn't really entirely work as such, but there are moments when it hits, there's those highs,
nothing touches it.
This is probably his most restrained work out of everything he's done. And it actually works. It's arguably probably his most commercial, funnily enough, even though it didn't really get much of a commercial release.
Yep.
And it's, you know, this is totally my shit because I'm fucking in for Gothic. This is Quebecia Gothic, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is Daphne du Maurier, Rebecca, essentially done on a farm. with the farm, you know, instead of like this beautiful Mandalay mansion, it's this rundown shithole and stuff clearing up out of Montreal. But otherwise, it's pretty close.
So the gist of the story, sorry, I should have done this earlier. If the gist of the story you're not getting, Tom, played by Xavier Dolan, he writes, he directs, he acts in this, goes home to attend the funeral of his lover, another man, to visit his family who have no, either they do know when it's blind or they don't know. He goes home to his mother, Agathe, played by Lisa Roy, and then his brother, Pierre Yves Cardinal. And he goes home to this family to commemorate his life and gets entangled in this incredibly weird relationship where he has to be completely restrained and not reveal to this extremely conservative small country town, you know, in Quebec, that's who their son was, number one, and that's who they are. And so, and that's who they were, and that's who their relationship was.
Yeah, but it's also, being in the closet is only like a tiny little
sort it's of a fraction
part
of
the whole thing. Because the whole thing, it is literally about this sort of twisted relationship, strangely codependent in some ways, on the farm that develops between the brother and Tom. And it's all driven by this sort of, like I said, the comparison to Rebecca is that because it's all driven by this character who has died off screen before the events of the film begin. And everything that ties that surrounds that and it has these gigantic implications of everything that's going on afterwards. And then throughout, there is a ton of like Hitchcock references.
Yeah.
Like this is not from there's a lot of parts of this film are silent, but then there is some score which sounds very much like the old Hitchcock scores. You have everything from running through cornfields. And hair that looks like cornfields, because to like the wrong man motif, to you know all that stuff. It's all you know, they can say Brian De Palma is like the sort of quintessential Hitchcock wannabe,
yes,
as in he sort of copies that sort of style. But this is probably Dolan's attempt, and it actually, in many ways, is more successful than some of De Palma's.
Yeah, because it just doesn't. It feels more. It's
lived
like
in.
It's like form and function, right? Some of those things immediately. I love how you said lived in. Some of those things feel so. they feel like a diorama, you know, because you're trying to orchestrate things and move the camera in ways that the camera wouldn't normally move. A wall moves out of the way. It's much like something like Panic Room, where someone might go, oh, like as a technical feat, like it's one of Fincher's best because of the way the camera moves and those things. But he's orchestrating the camera and the house is like basically bending to his whim around exactly how he wants to shoot things. Whereas I kind of tend to lean more to a Fincher Zodiac, for example, because it's a little bit messier and that feels like every part of the streets, the locations, the places they're going feel like they're alive, you know, even though he's very manicured and hermetically sealed in the way that he likes the camera to operate because he wants it the stillness to emphasize and exacerbate the feeling of the characters in the scenes. But this is just so like, it's got a little bit of like punk rock Rush about it, you know, like it just like, it's these beautifully manicured shots. And then the next scene, it's this like freakish, nightmarish chase through a cornfield, or it's like one, you know, a sudden fade to black and then panic, you know, it's just got that urgency that, you know, when I was watching it specifically so that we could talk about it so I could freshen up, I've watched it probably maybe one or two times since we saw it together. I was just like, wow. I know why this movie really had the juice for us, because it had the juice in a lounge room. Imagine in a gigantic theater in a dark place with a whole panicked audience not knowing what the fuck was going to happen. It was brilliant.
Well, that was the thing. I think I'd forgotten, and I was reminded on this walkthrough, is all the – it's just the shots. Is there are so many scenes where there's almost no medium shots in the film. There's like all these like long – like the interior of the house is almost shot from this way back. And then
ultra wide.
A little in the center, yeah. And then it will jump outside and you're in these gigantic empty environs, and yet it's claustrophobic as fuck. Yeah. There's so much tension in the air and so much this stuff going on. And then the camera will switch to this handheld, really, really close, intense sort of thing. And yeah, it's visually, it's quite stunning. And it tricks you in some ways because it's so muted. Because Dolan's like, it's almost like colorful, like a Fury Road kind of colorful. It's all super saturated in a lot of his films. Like it's like a Moldavar, but instead of set decoration, it's more like makeup or clothing or other shit. But with this one, it's like everything is just gray or muted colors at the most.
Yeah. And so we saw it then. We loved it. We walked out of there like, bang, that's fantastic.
Mm.
10 years on, we watch it again. We've both had these great experiences. And the massive, I guess, drive for us to talk about this movie is right now on Xavier Dolan's IMDb, there are 13 director credits. There's a couple of episodes of a mini series called The Night Logan Woke Up from 2022. There's a couple of massive Adele music videos, including Hello, It's Me, right? So that's on there. Mm-hmm. A couple of music videos, but he does I Killed My Mother in 2009, Heartbeats 2010, great film. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Anyways, 2012, really enjoyed that. 2013/15 for the purposes of the decade project, Tom at the Farm. Mummy, 2014. It's Only the End of the World, 2016. The Life and Death of John F. Donovan, 2018. And then Matthias and Maxime in 2019. And then crickets. Crickets.
Yeah.
Nothing. And even one of the most recent things I can find is on Deadline from Melanie Goodfellow in 2024 was that Xavier Dolan was saying that he was going to do a new film and that it was going to mark the second chapter in his work. He's 35, by the way, second chapter at 35. and yet that film hasn't appeared. I can't see it. Here on like
no, it's a horror film. I think at last I heard, yes, and it hasn't really progressed of anything.
Exactly, it says it in the interview that it's looking to be more of a horror film. It's going to mark this next thing, and I'm like, you know, it was apt while reading it because it's like you kind of made a horror film. It's called Tom at the Farm, but he's gone on and done some acting in between now and then. But this guy was, as our lovely French brethren called, was enfant terrible, like the sort of like problem child of this new movement, this new kind of Canadian new wave, if you like. He was the poster boy and he was going to be this big thing. And he really, for a stretch there, kind of was the next big thing and had people waiting.
It was a complete sort of upward trajectory up until Mummy.
Yeah,
Mummy was sort of the big sort of the sort of high he hit. And then it sort of came crashing down right after. And it was all tied to what happened at Cannes. And it was all when It's Only the End of the World premiered. And the reviews, because the reviews for all his previous work had just been, again, had also been going up and up and up. And then that was the first time he hit a really mixed review reaction.
Yes.
There was a lot of people who really didn't like it when it aired. And it was seen as like overconfidence. And he got quite publicly angry about it. And made comments about the reviewers and so forth, and that caused a bit of a rift in the sort of community and so forth. And yeah, there was some. Since then, it's been sort of downward, shall we say.
Yeah,
He
he
was
met.
he popped up a lot in acting for some reason around the late 2010s. Like he was in like the second It. He was in Boy Erased. He was in Bad Times at the El Royale and so on.
And
But
recently he was in like The Beast. He was in
yeah.
The Beast, which is there. So and Boy Erased was a bigger role for him in an English language movie. And so yeah, he's popped up, but it's really strange. It's kind of this like devastating thing. And yeah, it's cool to hear
Yeah.
like what it actually originated from, which is like the fact that
That's.
you can't just expect.
Yeah.
It's so funny. That is the sort of enfant terrible thing of it, which is you
Well, he
can't
was
ex.
only. You have to remember, this guy was early 20s when all this stuff was happening. He
Yeah.
made I Killed My Mother at 19. Actually, probably
Jesus.
less than that, probably less than 18. By the time sort of Mummy came around, that was probably, he was like just 24 or something. He was the sort of quintessential twink. Good looking, he had money, he could do whatever the fuck he wanted. Yeah, there was best the
Had
world was his one.
the world was his oyster in the
Yeah.
best possible way.
Yeah. And then there were some interviews where he was coming off a little cocky and so forth, and people were like, oh, okay. But we'll
How do
forgive
you
you for the
not drink the
moment.
Kool-Aid when you've made Mummy at
Yeah.
24? It's really hard to stay fucking grounded. And especially in a country like Canada and then in France, because he made his biggest splash at Cannes, like he's being kind of welcomed into the fold as a fully blown and fully formed auteur as a 24-year-old. It's like nuts. It's nuts.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You had the counter reaction to that film, but again, it was a local French film. And there were some big name stars in it, but it wasn't, it came and went. And then he tried the commercial prospects, the Hollywood prospects with John Donovan, and that didn't work either. And that had a lot of problems, that film. That was kind of famously, there were funding problems, there were production issues, there were the actual end product is missing about 45 minutes. There's a whole subplot with Jessica Chastain that got cut.
Crazy.
And it was it, the whole what is left of the film is kind of just sort of splashed up on screen. It's not really. They had to recast one of the roles, if I remember right, the young guy. And then, it was just a bit
Yeah,
of a mess, and the film ended up not that good.
here it is. Jessica Chastain films scenes as an antagonistic journalist obsessed with the news about John F. Donovan, which were cut from the completed movie during the timing and pacing. One of her scenes is in a bonus feature on the DVD.
But
So
there was a lot
Adele,
more to it.
yeah,
Yeah, it wasn't just her scenes that were cut. There was a lot more to that movie. I think the first cut came in around 3 hours,
Oh no, it
and
even
that
says
had
here the first cut ran for 4 hours. So it's like I
oh,
don't
4 hours. Wow,
four
yeah,
hours.
something I remember. Wow,
And the
and it got
final
cut down to like a bit over two.
Yeah, the final where the
Yeah, and
final
it didn't.
movie is 2 hours and 3 minutes, and that's with credits, which means it's 1 hour 56.
Yeah, it got cut to the bone, and then no offense to
Jesus.
Game of Thrones lovers, but Kit Harington is not the greatest idea for a lead in the movie.
No.
Yeah,
But
it
look
didn't
at
work. And
the cast is crazy. It's like it's Thandiwe Newton, who's now an Oscar winner, Susan Sarandon, Kathy Bates, Natalie Portman. There's four. Like for either Oscar winning or nominated folk, Jacob Tremblay, Kit Harington, who was like really hot at the time, Michael Gambon, fantastic. It's got a massive cast. And then Chastain would have made another Oscar winner in that movie. And it doesn't work. That's a crazy thing.
this didn't really click. I don't know, it was maybe he was just trying to stretch beyond what he wanted to do. I'm not sure why it just never clicked. I've seen it, and it's not as much a hatchet job as the Snowman, shall we say,
Yeah.
but
Mr. Police, we gave you all the clues.
But it is a case of you can feel that there's a whole stuff missing here, and this is not flowing at any in any way, really. And yeah, it's a shame with that one. It just felt like a complete misfire. And then the next one he did was actually quite good, and people really quite like Matthias Maxine. But it is a small little. It was back to his thing, and it's sort of. I'm not sure you can go home again, as they say.
Yeah, it's, and you hope that like. It's really funny, like not everything can be everything for everyone simultaneously, you know, like, and it's like, I think there's such a privilege in many ways to, if you're making independent films and he's making these Canadian films and he's making the productions with, you know, multilingual productions that are happening in Canada, what do we know about Canada? So much of Hollywood shoots in Canada. Like they just do. They've got great crews of people there. They're great production teams. They've got great locations. They've got huge studio spaces. Yep. You know, anything from Mission Impossible as a big film to like TV shows like The Flash, you name it. There's like people just live in Canada for 5 years making these bloody shows. Like it's just what happens.
Absolutely. Oh, there's so many Canadians get employed by US productions. It's insane.
Exactly. Right. So there's so many people, and it's a huge part of the industry that like Canada's like, yeah, we'll give you incentives. You come over here, you spend less money. We've got great crews and you make stuff here and our industry thrives and happy days. And the benefit then of the Canadian film industry is that, you know, they can take bigger risks with funding schemes and stuff like that for independent filmmakers to make their stuff. And also there's a stack of people who are very accomplished and probably have a ton of like even Hollywood or TV pedigree credits to go and make these smaller movies on a very modest budget.
Cronenberg's Canadian. He's probably one of the most famous ones to come out of there.
Exactly, right? So you can make really high quality, super high production design films on these scales, and they're fractionally costed as the same as the US ones, and they have much more play internationally, especially in French language speaking places, obviously, and maybe slightly less in America, who's still kind of got the resistance to subtitles, even though from what I hear, millennials now watch everything with
subtitles, yeah.
With subtitles, even in English. They just watch The Wire. Yeah. It's like, why don't you try listening?
I think a lot of people have actually overcome that thing. That's one of the big upsides of the streaming era, is that it has opened up a lot of international cinema and television in markets who never have traction before.
No.
And that's, yeah.
It's a really good thing. Like Squid Game, for example, being the most popular thing ever on the platform, it's like, well,
but even before that, the stuff like the Nordic Noirs that suddenly went everywhere.
Yeah, we love that. We love some Nordic Noir. So, it's really funny. It's like this guy just disappeared off the face of the earth. That's the huge sliding door in this movie. It's like the movie is of exceptional quality. He's an exceptional filmmaker. He has a resume with a couple of failures, but such colossal hits along the way. Yeah. Nothing huge.
Nothing huge. And I mean, Donovan was a bit of a fracas in terms of what happened there with the mess behind the scenes. But otherwise, since then, I mean, the next one he did went, like I said, the Matthias Maxine went well. Everyone liked it. The TV series he did, apparently the reception was quite good. But it has gone down the prestige series rabbit hole that a lot of filmmakers get caught up in. I mean, even if someone like, you know, Barry Jenkins or whatever, and Nicholas Winding Refn can do TV series, then they just get lost. With, you know, maybe appearing on a critics list or two, but otherwise they don't make much traction. You know, Dolan's going to hit the same thing, I'm afraid.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage 1. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
I mean, as good as the Underground Railroad is, I don't know what's more dangerous, Prestige TV where you get swallowed, or being hired by Disney or Marvel to make stuff, and then you're just in this soup for 10 years and you come out and you're like, you're like Neo waking up in the freaking in the little battery in the Matrix and like having no eyebrows anymore and you don't know where you are.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of creepy thing. But yeah, so it's just, it is incredible to me to see a guy who had this much potential and made this level of bangers at this time, who now is just not making movies. And it's like, is in international countries, I don't think, I mean, you probably cover it, but like, there's always this talk of the American independent cinema is like hyper independence, maybe gets picked up if it gets a good festival play and run by a streamer, very rarely gets a theatrical run, but it just seemed especially now, but it seemed like some of the international releases with countries that still had sort of thriving cinema, like cinematic culture, I guess, movie culture, like, you know, South Korea or France or Spain, or, you know, even like of years past, Iran, like loving homegrown stuff. It just feels like, how did this Canadian kid not get a chance to make stuff even in France, like going make stuff in France? He speaks French, you know, like, I don't get it.
Well, I mean, we can speculate, but the thing is, you know, he's at that age, so he's in his 30s now, and he'd be sort of at that age where he probably has a decent amount of money from everything he did, and whether he's just enjoying, you know, semi-retirement, who knows?
Man, to be retired at 35, what a dream.
Well, it's like, what is he, a tennis player?
You think you're Rafael Nadal? You're not allowed to do that shit, you know? Yeah, it's really crazy. I often watch that, like, in rugby league. Someone's like, "Oh man, this guy's been playing for years. How old is he?" 33. You're like, "Ugh, I'm old. I've been watching this guy play for 15 years. It's like, this is crazy." And he's a baby. He was a baby when I first saw him come on the scene. It's just really interesting. But I mean,
but he's left us with some good films. I can't sort of decry him for that.
Hey.
It's fun to go back to these movies. Like Tom at the Farm, I remember one of the famous things is where, because like I said, it's very restrained. And one of the sort of classic Dolan kind of thing was, there's a scene in it where the brother is choking out Tom. And it's this sort of, you don't know whether it's angry or horny, or it blurs the line between sort of erotic and kind of nasty and so on. And Dolan originally was going to have the brother give him a handjob in the scene, and it's like, and he said, maybe I'll pull back on that a bit.
Yeah, well, that's what's wonderful about the scene, because he's choking him and you think it's threatening, and then Dolan's Tom says harder, and the brother has to the brother goes through a series of emotions.
Yeah, it's all in silhouette, and it's like, you can see the brother kind of getting off on it as well, and it's all this sort of stuff, and it's like, oh, okay. But it reminds me of, in a way, of David Lynch.
Yeah.
In that, here you have a filmmaker who's known for their wild sort of eccentricities, for really just going off on their own thing. And when they're sort of restrained, when they're sort of pulled back into this kind of fitting into a bit of a format, you can get some amazing work. That's how you got Twin Peaks out of Lynch.
Yes.
It was because he was like forced to do something a bit more regular. And kind of, you know, you got some amazing stuff out of that.
Yeah. Well,
Mulholland Drive was partly that. Mulholland Drive was the famous thing where it was, you know, the first two thirds were the pilot that got cancelled and changed into a film. But that first two thirds was Lynch restrained. And then that last third is just Lynch.
Yes, yes. It's
and that's where it goes off the rails and starts munching out and small people and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's, but also then when you see, and I think that I like the Lynch comp, because Mommy would be like, that's his like full Lynch mode. Like, it's him in his feeling himself and feeling his style and feeling his impulses and instincts. But if you watch Straight Story by Lynch, which is a beautiful and stunning film that is told so straightforwardly and carefully, it's like, oh shit, this guy could have done anything that he wanted. He could have done any story ever, because he obviously did it with like Elephant Man, which is his own kind of levels of weird, but also very straightly told. And it's like, this guy can't
do
anything.
That's also early Lynch. Yeah.
This guy could do anything, but do we want him to? We want him to be him. We want him to go absolutely ham. That's what people want.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Cronenberg was kind of famous for, he was just wild at the start. He was just going off on crazy shit. Like video, you go watch a Videodrome or Naked Lunch or all that shit. And then you had History of Violence, which
this
by
was the
Cronenberg
period.
Standards, very restrained.
Yeah,
but
this was the period.
It was so good.
And then he backed that straight into Eastern Promises, which was unbelievable. Like, Eastern Promises. I don't know who I was talking to about it recently. It was perhaps, I think if you're listening to this live as we drop them, or you're listening to this on our main feed early, you know, in early 26, when they often do appear in the main feed, I think it's in the episode where I talked to Connor O'Donnell and Dan Mecca from the B-Side podcast, and we were talking about the film Mississippi Grind by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, which is one of their follow-ups to Half Nelson, which we all had such an amazing experience with. But the thing that gets me every time is Eastern Promises is just an amazing film. You know, I know our friend, you know, our dear friend Maria Lewis is such a huge proponent of that, wrote some of the best words I've ever seen about Viggo Mortensen's naked bathhouse fight as one of the great fight scenes in any movies. But it's, I think that's that restrained thing. That's just like it just shows how good his brain was for storytelling. It didn't always have to go into the extremity. He could tell really restrained stuff. It's a really beautiful mode of storytelling.
Absolutely.
It's a shame. I would like to see him just get like a Quebec-y noir. I don't even know. Do they have their own noir name or something? Like Quebec-y noir or something like that? Someone can come up with it. We might have just come up with it. But I mean, I think that he's definitely got all the chops. And seriously, like he works wonderfully with actors. He's a terrific actor, director himself, like having a command of how he wants the visuals to look. And especially at Tom of the Farm, he's unbelievable.
But Tom, as I said, Tom of the Farm is just, it's beautiful kind of as a gothic noir. It is almost exemplary on that front in terms of the way it's shot, the way it sounds, the way it's staged, just this general sort of storyline and so on. There are some pacing issues, but that's not unusual for the genre.
Yes.
But when it works, it's just, it's all, because it's so much of that genre is about the psychological, and that can be a tricky thing to pull off when you're dealing with what is essentially a three-hander.
Yes.
There is a fourth character who comes along for a brief period, but it is essentially a three-hander. And to do that interplay and then to play it with, he goes to some places where, you know, it is about repressed sexuality. That's a big part of that gothic genre, but he's not afraid to sort of go a bit more overt in that sort of stuff, which is typical him. But I want to see more from him. It doesn't matter whether it's the more restrained version or whether it's the wilder version. I just want to see more of what he can do.
Agree.
Whether we'll get it, I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those great unanswerables. Maybe on a decade project in 10 years' time, if we're still around. It'll be interesting to see if there's a Xavier Dolan film that comes out and it's like, oh, he's back. You know, he's made his big splash. He's back on the scene. Because I do want to touch
it
on this.
It can absolutely happen.
I do want to touch on this because this is also such in this gothic genre that you talk about, which is that there, at some point in the story, there's kind of a cautionary tale. And usually it's very early in the story where there's some kind of cautionary tale that seemingly has no connection to the story until it has all the connection with the story, much like there's old detective novels, you know, that's sort of piss taken in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, where there's two cases that they're discovering and then both cases are entangled by the end. One of the most unforgettable experiences of a scene that we had together, and I think we were sort of freaking out about it, is this sort of cautionary tale that Manuel Tadros, who plays bartender, bar owner, tells Tom towards the end, that there was a guy in town who, because of his sexuality, was, you know, horribly disfigured. And
But no, that's the whole thing. It's there's the subtle thing about
Oh, this. Oh, sorry. It's
throughout.
the inference. Yeah, is that he's disfigured.
Oh no, he seems disfigured. That's no question. Then that's the whole thing. But the reasoning why is the whole is the big subtle thing. Because throughout this entire movie, what is a big question is the relationship between the brothers.
Yes.
Because the brother obviously was aware that Guillaume was gay, but and whether there was issues with that is hard to say. But there's also this thing of whether there was an attraction there or not, not just to Tom, but to also potentially to Guillaume. And
Yes.
this guy has serious, you know, hanging man imaginary issues, shall we say? But it's the typical abusive sort of relationship with, between the two men, Tom. But we don't know what the relationship entirely was between him and Guillaume. And there's the implication that maybe Guillaume was potentially jealous of this person moving in on his brother and so on. And we don't know what was going on there. And then, yeah. As you describe it, we see the guy, sort of.
Sort of.
Yeah.
And
That's
so
beauty. We
it gives this
yeah.
cautionary tale that seems just like another layer of the weirdness of the relationship of the family. Sorry, that there's something going on, and the inference is that this poor kid who is disfigured has some unwanted advanced relationship, something. There's just something that happens that is just another layer of warning that there's something weird going on with these brothers, in case it hasn't already been rammed down our throat that there's something extremely fucking weird about these brothers. It's there. And so you don't really know how it's going to pay off. And in the conclusion of the movie, and I'll just say to fast forward, if you really haven't seen Tom at the Farm and you don't want the spoiler, fast forward now. About 20 seconds, I'm going to go. So basically, in that moment where he comes to the end of the film and he's stolen Francis's car and he's getting the hell out of Dodge and he's filling up with fuel and he sees this kid and doesn't know if he can face this deformity, it's like it reinforces that no matter all of Francis pleading, no matter anything, he's like he's made the right decision, like to get the hell out of there. And Evelyn Brochu, who's like the Sarah who comes in and pretends to be Guillaume's girlfriend just to get Tom the hell out of there. What a great handbag of a friend she is, a legend. She comes in to do so. And yeah, it's just that one further nail in the coffin that he needs to get the hell out of there. And there's no happy path of them living together. There's nothing. It's just
No.
it was always going to be a mistake.
And it always in these sort of films, it always ends in tragedy in some ways. And then there's I mean, the beauty with that one was there's been multiple times in the movie where he could have gone, or he could
Yes.
easily have left, and he doesn't, and he chooses voluntarily to stay. And then the Sarah character is kind of the splash of cold water he needs, but yeah, it's a fun role to play for the actress, I admit. But yeah, there's multiple times where, I mean, that's the beauty of some of these sort of gothic ones. There's in Rebecca, there's famous scenes where it's essentially records the three-hander as well. It's the housekeeper, the husband, and the new wife. And it's all about the dead wife who was, you know, died off screen, whatever. But it becomes this thing with the new wife and the housekeeper, and she's almost like there's a scene towards the end of the Hitchcock film where she's basically trying to get the new wife to commit suicide. And just by, you know, just gently whispering into her ear, it's all through this sort of psychological pressure. And it's like, yeah, you're waiting. You want those are the scenes that make the movie. It's this thing of this manipulation and thing. And yeah, throughout the movie, you don't think someone like Francis, who's this just brute, essentially, is capable of this sort of. It requires a certain amount of intelligence to pull off this sort of gaslighting and manipulation of people, but he does. And Tom, as much as he gets out in the end, there's a scene where he's throughout the credits where he's driving back into Montreal, and then you're thinking, is he really out
I hope,
mentally?
yeah,
And I
like
don't know.
it's like the cycle of grief and this kind of Stockholm syndrome that he's developed very quickly, probably because of his increased vulnerability at the entire situation and how detached and strange it is, and how he's denied any opportunity to truly grieve about that. It's this amazing layers of like stuff that you can read into it, even though it's not necessarily explicit in the film, but it's like you're like, oh, for the love of God. Like, this is the second movie after On the Decade Project, like the Mississippi Grind. It's like at the end of Mississippi Grind, Ben Mendelsohn's character and Ryan Reynolds' character make money and they leave each other and they split and it's great. And there's this moment where it's like, do you think that Ben Mendelsohn's not going to go and gamble that money away and piss it away and do something wrong? And it's just like, just for that brief moment, I'm like, lie to me. And I think even more so or more overtly in Tom at the Farm, Dolan is having a field day, prodding the audience, going, is he gonna not? Is he gonna turn around? Is he gonna come back? Is he gonna come back? And you're
I
like,
mean, when
don't.
the freaking tires get taken off the car, it's like, dude, get out
Get
of
out.
there.
Get like, grab your bag and start walking down the road. Like, I can't stress this enough. What a
But
great one.
one thing we haven't discussed actually, and one of the things that draws us still 10 years on, the one scene in
Oh.
this movie, the dance scene.
There is a moment where Francis, for context for folks who haven't seen it, there's a moment where Francis reveals to Tom that his brother Guillaume, an uncredited Caleb Landry Jones, for those playing at home, has gotten him salsa dancing lessons to help him socialize. I mean, that's not going to help completely. But anyway, in a heightened moment of stress about this entire situation, and where Francis actually shows some cracks that make him, make him sort of empathetic towards his situation, his plight, having to look after his mother, his mum sort of going off the rails, and now she's even further off the rails because of Guillaume's death.
And he's isolated and,
Isolated,
all
can't
that
go
other stuff.
anywhere, can't leave her, all those things. He's there to keep the farm alive and keep their livelihood, and he has no choice but to
And it's
work.
not an easy life in by any stretch.
No, it sucks. So he takes a moment, he drags Tom into a barn, and you're like, oh God, what hellish situation is about to await him? And he reveals that he got salsa lessons. So he starts dancing. He takes off his
Essentially a
flannel.
tango, yeah.
Yeah, a flannel shirt. He reveals a black tank top. He's there and he starts dancing. And he's just, and in the midst of this tango, which increasingly is heated, beautiful, sensual, Francis has this stream of consciousness where he basically says all of his darkest inner monologue feelings to Tom, and they dance. And the electricity of that scene is the single scene that after 10 years, I can imagine many filmmakers watch and go, how the hell did he create the conditions to have a scene which at face value could be so patently ridiculous in the structure of the movie, but that just seems to work so profoundly. And the choices of how the camera moves, how slow it is, how fast it is, how intimate their movements are, and then the moment where you realize that Agathe, who's Francis and Guillaume's mom, is watching Tom and Francis dance and hearing him
And
say all
hearing
these things.
everything.
And then the camera pulls back so that you can barely see anything but her silhouette in the door. And it's just crazy. It's one of the best scenes. If there was a best of the decade or best of the 20th century scenes, I would put this scene right up there in that conversation. It would be first ballot for me of like the scene of the century is one of these.
It's so just emotionally, erotically, it's erotic, it's emotional, it is visually like the ramp ups and the slowdowns at points, the way that Dolan's got terrible hair throughout this movie. He's like a Hitchcock blonde, essentially the straggly
It
blonde, looking like a straggly blonde sort of curls,
looks
whatever.
like a Hitchcock
But it
blonde, like a
works for
month.
this
It looks
scene.
like a Hitchcock blonde a month after she's finished shooting a Hitchcock movie where she's had to bleach her hair blonde, and it's like her hair is struggling back, it's dead, it's like split ends, it's like all crinkly, But in this scene, he looks magnificent.
And we're like, it's all being swept around and everything, and then combined with like Francis with the shortcut and everything like that, doing it. And the way that whole lighting through the garage comes
Oh.
through, it all feels like it's in a sunset kind of golden glow. And yeah, it's just beautiful. And then, yeah, it just ends on that dead silence of, the mum not saying anything. And then she just offers apple pie or something like that. And you're like, fuck. There's so much of the tension in just regular conversations here. That's why it's such a great film.
Such a good film. Thank you for being here to talk to me about it. It's hard to find at the moment in Australia on streaming. It's a little bit hard. You do have to like Blu-ray to get it. I believe internationally more easy. Dolan's films just in general seem more easy from my research that you can get them on a lots of, you know, I think all of us have got like three or four of these bloody streaming services at a minimum anyway. But so if you need to go seeking it out,
the average is four these days.
Yeah. I'm above average.
At one point I had 19. Those days are over. I'm now down to like a 12, I think.
I don't know how many I'm up to. Don't make me do the math on this. Anyway, I'm up to too many. I don't.
Yeah.
This is the thing. I don't find myself watching many of them.
No.
I'm in my office in the 1 8 minute production studio man cave, and I'm watching things on physical media because that's such is my inclination. But it's harder to find, but the Blu-ray is out there. It's definitely not out of print. You can pick it up. Definitely worthwhile having a collection. If you haven't seen it, it's a tremendous film. And if you haven't heard of Xavier Dolan, a whole bunch of those films are absolutely worth your time, particularly just going back through his resume. If you're
I would say Mummy, Tom at the Farm, and I Killed My Mother. Those three are kind of essentials.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sort of take them for what they are. Most of the others, you know, it's various.
Heartbeats and Lawrence Anyways are still very good there, but they're certainly second tier when you're talking about that. It's like Mummy, Tom at the Farm, I Killed My Mother, absolute tippity top, top three, amazing. Lawrence Anyways and Heartbeats for me are that next tier, and then the later films
sort of come under that.
I would say
Matthias would probably be up in the second tier.
That's one I haven't seen. That's one I haven't seen. So I'm keen to see it. Where did you see that? Was that an iTunes-y one for you?
That was I think that was a movie.
A movie?
Came out.
Okay.
It was a movie title. Yeah.
Okay. Well, those of you who are getting Mubi, you can check that out. I used to have Mubi, one of the streaming services I had.
But those, just to give you a basic sell of the premise, it's essentially about a straight guy and a gay guy who have been childhood friends. And for a filming project, like for a dare, they have to kiss. And it opens. And normally in these sort of films, the boring sort of, you know, usual story would be that the gay guy's having weird sort of security issues and is, you know, infatuated with the straight friend and all that. This reverses that. This has it. So the straight one is the one who's left questioning who's he's already in a relationship and he's wondering, oh, fuck, what the hell am I thinking here? And it ends up being quite a sort of adult drama in terms of it treats it actual sort of real life. It doesn't do the melodramatic stuff. It doesn't try and delve into stereotypes. It actually, they settle on a quite comfortable, very sort of mature sort of way to approach the material. And it's a solid little movie.
Well, that sounds good. So that I'm going to catch up with. And now I feel like even though I was completely meh on the death and life of John F. Donovan, I kind of want to watch it again to see like the snowman hack job of it all. Like that's a storyline that now that is stuck in my head. Garth Franklin, thank you so much. Everyone, if you want to follow Garth, just go to darkhorizons.com. You'll see, you know, an average of somewhere between 13 and 30 articles a day that he's been doing since 1990 fucking eight. So
do all for this shit.
He's been doing this forever and he's the best at it. And that's why he's the best place to go. One of my dearest friends. Thank you, sir, so much for doing this. Check out Tom at the Farm, guys. Follow us. If you're listening to this in early 26, our series, The Decade Project, happens all throughout the year as an early look as it's unfolding week by week on our Patreon. It is worth your money to subscribe to get the first look at it as we go throughout the year. 40 episodes minimum a year is what we're going with. So enjoy. It started off with like 6, then it was like 9, and now we're in the late 30s or nearly to our 40th episode of the year with more bonuses to come. So if you enjoy that, subscribe on 1 8 Minute Productions Patreon, support everything that we do, as well as all of our great free shows you get on our main feed. And otherwise, you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait. We'll be ahead of you there. But thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you on a new episode of The Decade Project soon.